and welcome to Back Chat from the Bristol Radio Co-op. Hello to everyone in Bristol and listeners on Preston FM. That's 103.2 FM up in Preston. Nikki Radio in Hertfordshire and to our listeners in Swindon. Hello Swindon FM. Coming up in the show.
But I do think there's a kind of general trend which is not necessarily only American. It's to do with a kind of globalization of culture. So the same force that means that certain coffee chains are repeated endlessly throughout British cities.
We're back with the architects this week, Sean Griffiths on globalization of architecture.
There's lots of community opera that have bred down to a more amateur level, like Noah's Flood, which a lot of people have heard of, yet no big productions done of that because it's usually generally amateur production. Midsummer Night's Dream is quite well known too. There's not one standout like opera that's hit is famous for. I think he wrote between 13 and 15 full-scale operas though, and quite a lot of them were chamber operas.
Bristol University students present a production of Midsummer Night's Dream in advance of Benjamin Britten's centenary next year. And we'll also be featuring the latest situation in Syria. I'm Kirsty Paul. We have James Bruce with us in the studio. Welcome, James.
Thank you. I'm very happy to be here, Kirsty. Thanks.
So, James, you have some interesting tales to tell us about something which not many of us are in the habit of doing, a pilgrimage.
Well, that's right, yeah. There aren't very many people who have an opportunity to go on pilgrimages the way that I have. It started off a walk from Bristol, here in Bristol, which took me to Walsingham. That's a place in Norfolk. That took 8 days. I can't remember how many miles it is. It's maybe, oh no, I'm not very good at numbers actually. But anyway, it's a long way. And that was something that I wanted to try and prove that I could do to myself and to one or two others. And then afterwards, a number of different things happened. I went to a talk by the Patriarch of Jerusalem in London. And on the way over there, I had this idea that it would be an extraordinary thing to try and walk as far as I could to the holiest place of not only Christianity, but of course Judaism, and one of the most holy places in Islam as well, in Jerusalem. So that was January 2010. I set off in the snow and walked across France and Italy, across the Balkan countries, Bulgaria, Turkey, which is a huge country, incidentally. That took me through Syria, Jordan, and to the Holy Land. That was just an extraordinary experience, seeing so many places and meeting so many people, nice people everywhere, absolutely wonderfully kind, hospitable people, which was just a revelation to me. And also, not least, I should mention in Serbia, because perhaps sometimes we don't always have the best impression of Serbian people, and they were among the nicest people I met, but there were nice people everywhere, and not least in also Turkey. And whenever I see things about Syria now on the news, it's terribly depressing for anyone who's been to Syria. It's a wonderful country, and so sad to see the terrible suffering and bloodshed that's going on there now.
Fabulous journey, and all done on foot.
Well, more or less.
That's quite inspiring. So a pilgrimage, as most of us would understand, is for a religious intention. Is that the case with you?
Yes, that's an important part of it. It comes from a belief that God can use a pilgrimage like that. But also, practically, there was an intention to raise money for a very worthy charity called Mary's Meals that some listeners may have heard of. The focus for Mary's Meals is to provide a meal in school so that children can attend school. Very often in the world's poorest communities, if there isn't any food at school, the children are simply not able to attend because they'll have to go off and scavenge or find some kind of menial kind of work or something, anything to just be able to eat. But they can't attend school, and therefore they won't get an education. And that's what Mary's Meals has identified, is that those children are exactly the people who need to be at school. And if they don't have food, they won't be there. So that's what they provide. And they have focused on providing locally sourced food, which helps obviously the local economy and gets everyone in the local community involved as well, and enabling some of these very, very poor children to go to school. And in fact, it's growing at an extraordinary rate. There are something like about 700,000 children now receiving these meals in different countries all around the world. But
that was going to be my question. That's international then, so really reaching the poorest areas in the poorest countries.
That's right, yeah. And in fact, it's got a sufficiently high profile, partly because of some quite high profile people who have promoted it. And one of them, for example, listeners might not be the biggest fan of his politics, but I went up to Scotland, which is where they started, where the charity originates, and they presented a fantastic film about the charity called Child 31, in case anyone comes across it, about the story of Mary's Meals, and that was presented by Gordon Brown. So he was there in person and gave a very impressive talk about what Mary's Meals does and the inspiration that it is for children, and especially providing hope for so many children. In fact, he probably made a few friends that day, even though not everyone is a huge fan of his politics necessarily.
So Mary's Meals, is that for international schools, or is there any instances that they help out in the UK as well?
It's been in countries where the level of poverty has been really more serious than you find yet. I mean, please God, it won't ever be quite like it is in so many different parts of Africa and India, and Haiti is another place where they are. But yeah, I mean, those are places where poverty is absolutely has a devastating effect on the local population, whereas thankfully we're not quite in that position now, although they do also operate in some places in Europe. In some isolated instances, there are places where they provide the same service in Ukraine and in Bosnia, so that's where they also are.
It's a fantastic push for children to be able to attend school, get an education, and remove that barrier to them being able to do so. Quite impressive. So going back to what you said about God being able to use a pilgrimage, I'd just like to hear a little bit more about what inspired you to take the route that you took, and quite how it felt to you.
I knew which route I was going to go across France, but thereafter I was more or less making it up as I went along. I had maps that I would just find along the way, mostly. But there's lots of things to do with pilgrimage that are very much associated with providence. So just one example of this, I had this idea to go on that pilgrimage to Jerusalem as a result of a visit to London, and that was on what we in our church, we celebrate Our Lady's birthday. That's Mary's birthday on the 8th of September.
So it's worth clarifying that you're a Catholic.
That's right, yeah, I'm a Catholic. Although I don't like to make a big deal of that. I mean, although, yes, that's right, I am a Catholic, but I also believe very passionately in the importance of extending the hand of friendship among different denominations so that we can be as unified as we can in this society that, after all, is increasingly rejecting the essentials of Christianity. So therefore, the best thing is if we can try and not to squabble among ourselves, which is what we've done.
So the idea behind your pilgrimage is to, as you're travelling, to reach out to people. And it sounds as if you had a lot of interaction with local people as you travelled.
Yep, that's certainly true. I wouldn't ever actually ask to stay, for example, with somebody, but it was offered to me that somebody would say, or people would offer me a place to sleep. But otherwise, I also had a big sleeping bag, and I often had to improvise places to sleep, whether it was very often bus shelters, also in derelict buildings or under bridges or under the road, that kind of place. If I stopped in a cafe or a restaurant, I'd be presented with free food and things like that. People would be just curious, and then they would be very willing to part with sometimes their food and sometimes give me financial help as well, just to keep me going. And that was always a great encouragement as well.
I can imagine you got into quite a few interesting conversations along the way.
Yeah, well, that's true. The one that comes to mind was actually a conversation I had in Syria. There was a guy who was very suspicious of me, and I was walking at night because it was so hot in Syria. It was incredibly hot during the day, so I was walking during the night, and this particular young guy didn't like the look of me. And we had a conversation about whether or not I was going to Israel, because generally they don't like the Israelis in Syria. There's this very long-running disputes between the two countries. They've been at war. So I didn't ever admit that I was going to Israel, but this guy was adamant, and he was pretty clear that I must be. And Anyway, what happened eventually was I took out a thing which I had in my bag, which was something that I hoped would lighten the mood of him and his friend, and that was an inflatable gun that I had with me. That was a memorable occasion when I just took this gun out and blew it up and sensed that the atmosphere had been lightened considerably by that.
I like the way you said that in such a deadpan way. So that was either going to be kill or cure, really, wasn't it?
Yeah, well, the thing was, I knew it was going to be something that they probably would find funny because, yeah, I'd had the experience of using it already on a previous encounter with people in the Balkans. And so that was on the way there, on the way to Syria.
Thank you, James. You can hear part two of James's pilgrimage next week. Music now from Pink Floyd, and this track is Goodbye, Cruel World.
Goodbye, all you people. There's nothing you can say to make me change my mind. Goodbye.
How old are you?
I am 21.
What do you think about all the wars in the world?
Well, obviously they're all for different reasons, but specifically in terms of the attacks on and the illegal occupation of Gaza and West Bank is tyranny, it's systemic genocide. There's nothing right about it.
Do a lot of your friends feel the same?
Yeah, I'd say a lot of people do. I think the biggest issue is that and not enough people know about the issues because media is influenced so heavily to distract people from what are the fundamental issues in the world. And I think there's a significant issue with how much my generation is being exposed to the problems that we face as a species.
Before we introduce the next studio guest, we're going to hear from Syrian protesters in front of the Brandenburg Gate, Berlin, a gate which has witnessed many scenes of civic and historical unrest.
I'm here with some people from Syria, yeah. And we have on the floor in front of the Brandenburg Gate, Free yeah. Syria.
Yeah, they are all Syrians.
So can you tell us the situation in Syria at the moment?
Yeah, situation is Syria is a country under slaughter. The regime is launching a very heavy military attack. And you see they have the heaviest weapons, which are fabricated or made or just to launch heavy attacks against armies, not against civilians. So civilians are, let's say, exposed to heavy casualties in Syria. So even the civil infrastructures also are destroyed. People are unable to move. We have no schools. We have even no nursing, no medicaments, no hospitals at all. So this is a real situation in Syria. People were dismissed from their jobs. And people have no income now, no economic circulation or no economic markets in Syria still exist. So people get poor, people are killed, people get afraid, worried, under detention. We have almost 300,000 under detention now, 300,000. We have almost 30,000 have been killed until now. And we have the people never go their jobs and never feel safe to go outside or to move or to communicate each other. So we have dead life, completely dead life, and we are suffering a lot of casualties. 32,000, I told you, and we have around 150,000 injured. We have no hospitals and no medicines. So many people are taken under so small houses in order to have treatment or remedy or medicament. Even the doctors are unable to do that because they are exposed to be arrested and they are liable to be killed and so on. And no pharmacies are permitted to dispense any medicines unless the old prescription will be verified by the government or by security. So No pharmacies do sell medicines. No doctors are, let's say, appointed or liable to help injured people. So this is the situation in Syria. And most of these casualties are launched by helicopters, by air force, and by heavy guns, by heavy artilleries. So this is the situation.
Why doesn't the West do more to help?
We call on the West, since they are members of the International Security Council, General Assembly, since human rights have been the genuine base of the democrat liberal societies in the West. We call them that we are Syrians, we are members of the founders of United Nations. We are members of Arab League, we are members of Islamic Conference, we are members, etc., etc. We call on them just to save us, save our souls. We don't call them to bomb Syria, but to find a way through international security, how to save us, how to keep us alive, how to save our souls. They are committed to help us because we are members in one community. And we all are committed to human rights. According to their responsibility for human rights, they should forward a lot of helps to support us. We are now alone. We are with a regime who still have 5,000 tanks and 600 aeroplanes and 500 helicopters. We have nothing in Syria. So this is not quite balanced between those who have a gun to resist, to secure their homes, etc., and those who launch attacks by helicopters and by artillery and by all kinds of heavy weapons. That is the situation.
How are you going to get the help that you need?
I tell you, through Security Council, through human organizations, and through embassies in Syria, still have the embassies and working, and through other neighboring countries. I think before there was an English parliament member who drove a lot of convoys to help the Palestinians.
Galloway,
Mr. Galloway. So we want Mr. Galloway now to come to Syria to make a new convoy with other Galloways to come to do that. We want the West to be human once more. When they came during the Crusaders for any other claims, now we have more human claims, more legal claims now to help us. So we call on them, we request them to come forward and to take all initiative to help us. We kindly ask them, we request them, we will be committed to legal laws, we will never be terrorists, we will never be Islamic fanatic fundamental. We are calling for democracy. That is genuine. We are calling for the change of dictatorship which lasted through the ruling on one family for 42 years. This situation is not acceptable in this age. No other regime in the world still exists with similar characteristics as Assad regime. So the world must help to change this regime in order to transfer into democracy. They should not hide behind that claim that we are terrorists or we are Muslim fundamental. This is idiot. If they want democracy, if they want Iran not to come closer 2,000 kilometers in Syria, the east of Mediterranean, they now build missile bases in Syria. The Iranian, instead of challenging Europe, the West in the Gulf, now they challenge it in Syria now. And most of the area will change into that Ayatollah fundamental fanatic idiots. So we call the West to be cowards, sorry to say, unless they initiate to stop this fanatic empire, Iranians with Hezbollah, who press the all territorial regional countries in order to keep Assad regime and Assad. We have a project for democracy. We are calling for democracy. We are calling for human rights. We got for sovereignty, integrity, etc. And we are not fundamentalists. And we are not Iranians. Since we stand as anti-Iranian and anti-Hezbollah, so we are not fundamentalists. We are Democrats. We believe that Iranians and Hezbollah are our major enemies and major alliances of Assad dictatorship. That's why we call on the West to reconsider the whole situation and to take all initiative to help us in order to manage the democracy change and democracy transference. This is what we want. So we ask them to help us by all the means. And they are great nations. They are powerful. They have navies. They have air force. They have all the instruments and all the ways through which they can help us.
So over to our guest, Sakir Yildirim, who has returned from taking an ambulance with vital medicines over to Syria. You may remember that Sakir was instrumental in taking a convoy to Gaza and was caught up in the ambush by Israeli soldiers. Welcome, Sakir. You're here today to talk about the work that you're going to be doing, taking some hospital supplies to Syria. But I understand that you have been quite active in the last couple of years, taking aid to various areas that have been experiencing conflict. Would you like to tell us a little bit more about that?
Yeah, I've just been back in 2008-09, CAST-led operation to Gaza, taking an ambulance there. That was 2009, January. 2010, I've taken a giant articulated lorry with full of medical supplies to Gaza, second. And third, been to Marvin Marmara boat. I suppose everyone knows about that one. There was 9 people killed. And then here, Bristol, people was trying to take some ambulances to Libya. And I was trying to help for that, but I wasn't very much of help on that one. And lately, taking an ambulance to Syria, and about 2 weeks ago I just got back from Syria, delivered the second ambulance, and there might be a third one in January, in the new year, for another ambulance, and maybe some warm blankets and some warm clothes for kids.
So it sounds like you've been very active trying to support areas that have been experiencing conflict. Can you tell us a little bit more about your motivation and what drove you to do this?
Well, people just sitting there and watching on the TVs and saying, well, oh, it's too bad, we can't do anything. Well, I think everyone can do something. Maybe pound sometimes helps. So rather than sitting indoors and doing nothing, I've decided to go on to that one as well.
So it's really responding to the conflict from the news reports that you've heard and feeling like something proactive needs to happen. So have you been doing this as part of a wider group or charity?
Well, it's IHH in Turkey. I'll just go and do what I do here, collect money or aid or anything, trying to do it with them. Sorry, I forgot to say, actually, there was an earthquake last year in Turkey. I attended that one as well. And that was pretty bad. So, you know, seeing these, whatever's going on in the world, wars or earthquakes, it just, ordinary people just like you and me, getting the bad side of the things anyway.
So a real compassionate response, and quite impressive.
Yeah, I mean, some of the Syrians that I saw a couple of weeks ago all got posh cars. They've got enough money to live in Turkey, hire a flat, and they live happily ever after. But the poor people just trying to live on the tents and the kids, what those kids done to Assad or anyone, deserve to die.
So this is a straight response to what you've seen and how you felt. So do you generally travel on your own? Say if you were driving the articulated lorry, who is it you would be doing that with?
Normally do it on my own. I just get up and just do it. Do it.
And do you get much response from your local community?
I do get a lot of support from family, friends in and around Bristol, and some from London. So the Turkish community does help. So obviously without their help, I won't be doing what I was doing.
So are you quite well known in the Turkish community? Are there other people that are doing the equivalent of what you are?
Well, they do know me. Yeah, there's not many of us. There's only a few of us, but there you are.
you're basically taking action where a lot of people would be very nervous, very cautious, because a lot of people give to charity. A lot of people see that as the way that they move forward and help. You take physical action. So is that something that you have always had a history of doing?
I can sit down and do the what other people do, you know, just give money and just clear your conscience. But I just wanted to do, actually, seeing the money get into there, the place. There is people out there collecting money. Sometimes, you know, they might be genuine and the money is getting there. But in my time, I have seen, actually, some bad things as well. People collecting money, maybe, I don't want to say this, but the money, half of it might be going into his pocket. So I just wanted to see it myself. People who knows me, they know me as well. So I'll just, whatever, I take 100% donation. So
fantastic. And what kind of response do you get when you turn up with something like an ambulance or an articulated lorry full of medical supplies? I can imagine that's quite an incredible thing for people to take receipt of.
Well, I don't know how to describe that. It just, you know, people do think, even a little toy, if you just give it to, I had that in Gaza. There was this little girl was crying on the grandmother's, she was really crying. I said, hold on, and I couldn't speak the lingo. I've just jumped into the ambulance, and I just grabbed something from one of the toys, and it was a little dolly, and I just gave it to her, and you should have crying just stopped immediately, and you should have seen the smile. So that's getting me going.
Absolutely, and the smile on the grandmother's face as well, I can imagine.
Yeah, so I mean, she was trying to tell me their father was died, so.
So these terrible yeah. stories of yeah. pain and suffering. So
you can imagine what people like. And that ambulance, I never thought it was that much stuff in it. And I've been to a few places, and I was just trying to empty it. And it would not empty. And I would just keep giving stuff to people. And that was great. And I had some money to give it to people. So, yeah, that's getting me going. So in this Syria thing as well. Same again, just people seeing different person going into their country trying to deliver an ambulance, you know, people coming in, thank you.
So you hope, as you were saying earlier, to do another expedition in the new year. Do you have plans for that, and are you actually raising funds at the moment?
Yes, I'm trying to raise some funds for Gaza and Syria this time. I've got some friends in Macedonia. They wanted to buy an ambulance and send it to Syria, and they asked me if I can do it for them. I said, okay. So I was trying to do some, as I said earlier, some blankets and warm clothes for kids of Syria. And then obviously this Gaza happened, so trying to collect some money for that. If everything goes according to plan, somewhere in January, mid-January, I suppose, buying the ambulance and buying the stuff from Turkey, clothes and the blankets, it's a lot cheaper, and less custom formalities.
So you get more for the money you've had donated.
And take it to Syria, then come back to Turkey and fly out to Gaza.
Do you ever get scared? Because these are real missions that you're going to, areas that aren't safe.
I got bombed, shot at, missiled. Well, so, yeah, still here, so we've gone past that stage. I'm scared. No, if we're gonna die, we're gonna die. We only got one life, live it. So do what I want to do. Help.
As we've spoken about your next expedition, if we do have any listeners that would like to donate, where should they go to be able to do that?
I mean, they can always go to Turkish community, but they know me there obviously, so they're on Gloucester Road, 270 Gloucester Road in Bristol. They can always take it there and just stick and say for Gaza or Syria. Yeah, donations welcome.
Thanks there to Sakir Yildirim, just returned from Syria on a life-saving mission.
So I have Clive Belton with me. You're going to talk to us about Bristol Books. Would you like to enlighten us?
Thank you, yes. Well, after I brought out my book Trenches to Trams in 2011, I've really been bitten by the book bug. I do a lot of voluntary work at Bristol Record Office, where I help to digitise the city's lovely film collection. and make that available to members of the public.
And that's currently available, isn't it?
Currently available. People can actually go into the Bristol Record Office and view 100 films that we've digitised in the search room and go through a catalogue and dial up any film you want to look at. It's a terrific resource, so I can highly recommend it. But my work at the Record Office and with the museum service generally has showed me there's so many fantastic stories that get deposited with the archives. And if we're not careful, a lot of those stories will be missed. So myself and my publisher of...
And that's Tangent Books,
Tangent
isn't
Books,
it?
And my friend Richard Jones, he and I started talking about maybe there's scope for another Bristol publishing company at the same time as I was speaking to another chap. And in the end, four of us pooled our resources and formed Bristol Books as a community interest company. So we're a not-for-profit community interest company whose aim is to produce sort of legacy publications that can go on forever. And in our research, if we come across items, photographs, effects that should be donated, then we'll at least encourage people to donate those collections to the appropriate museum. So that's really the background to why we wanted to set up Bristol Books, because of there's so many stories of events, people, places around Bristol and the surrounding areas that we thought, well, let's give it a go.
What's the focus of your first couple of publications?
They'll be covering people, places and events. Our first book, for example, is called Adj, King of the Wurzels. So it's a biography, the first ever biography written about Adj Cutler, who in the West Country was a great sort of raconteur and songwriter of all sorts of mostly cider-related books. And of course, Adj spawned the Wurzels, and the West Country legends have been going for years. And
so there's a certain generation between Jasper Carrot who know who the Wurzels are.
Yes.
But possibly not really understand they're a lot more than a joke band or a comedy outing. They're quite influential and quite important.
Oh, very much so. And I think if you look at the way Adj Cutler crafted his songs, they are very, very, very cleverly written. And he was a bright chap, a very bright chap. And he was also roadie for Acker Bilk and his jazz men. He did that for years. But what people will hopefully realise when they read the book when it comes out, there was a lot more to Adj than just being a potentially a sort of a comic character with his Wurzel stick and his Wurzel hat on. So that's one book. Another book we're going to be bringing out is called Riot, and it's about the Bristol Bridge Massacre of 1793. It's a book that was published previously by Mike Manson, the author. It's been out of print for at least 10 years now. So Mike is giving us the authority, if you like, to publish another updated version of his book. So that's an event.
That's obviously a story you thought worth telling. Do you want to quickly precy it to let us all know why this book is
well,
back in...
Well, it's quite an academic historical perspective book about this particular event that happened in Bristol, and it's all to do with really the restrictions around tolls and getting in and out of the city, the way the militia operated. And during the Brakar, 14 people lost their lives actually on that Bristol Bridge area. So it's historically it's quite an important thing for people of Bristol not to forget. So that's one of our aims really as Bristol Books, is to make sure that even if stories might have been told before, there could well be a new generation that haven't heard a particular facet. So why not refresh some of these stories that are out there? And one of my interests, and it's a book I'm working on at the moment, is to tell the story of a boys' club in Bristol, Bedminster Down Boys' Club, operated from 1941 during the Second World War up until 2004 when it closed. And it closed through, I think, a range of reasons. The lads never wanted to transfer to a youth club and allow girls to join. The area was sort of declassified by the city council as a needy area, so it lost its £30,000 a year grant, and that really helped to keep the club going. It was a great show. I went there for a 5 or 6 year period between 69 and 76. And what it did for a lot of lads, if they didn't get much of an education at school, if they didn't get very good sort of parenting, then the boys' club really helped them develop that transition from sort of boyhood to manhood. It was very, very useful. The club won a lot of drama awards as well, national drama awards, some of which were televised by the BBC nationally. So it had a fantastic reputation for drama. Lots of celebrities used to visit the club on their sort of celebration evenings. And we've recently uncovered 50 photograph albums and documents, huge great things, going back to the 1940s. Wonderful archive, and Bristol Record Office have agreed to take the whole archive from us and store it for safekeeping. But we're going to use that and do oral histories of some of the lads and get their stories together and publish that in the book. And given the film material we have, we might well do a screening. There's enough material for an exhibition. Some of our projects, like this one, won't necessarily be commercially viable in the sense of a book. But by setting ourselves up as a community interest company, it means we can seek grant aid from people like the Heritage Lottery Fund, the Arts Council, and other sort of charity giving organisations to help fund some of these costs.
There must have been an awful lot of inspiring people that were running these clubs. And
yeah, absolutely. And I think the inspiration, one of the main inspirations at Bemis and Our Boys Club was a chap called Steve Long. And he was in the sort of Bristol youth club movement in the 1960s. And he became club leader in 1964. And he really, for the next 25 years, was instrumental in taking the club forward. People really did look up to Steve, but Steve had a particular interest in drama and music, and that enabled the lads who were keen on that as well to actually flourish. And some of them have gone on to direct plays and be in the drama movement, are still involved there today. And in terms of kind of mentoring power or skills, a friend of mine is now a social worker in Denmark. So he's a naturalised Dane. He's been there for 30 years. He got in touch with me on Facebook a few weeks ago and just said, "Clive, every day of my working life, Steve Long is still on my shoulder." So that just shows you what it meant to some of the lads who were there and what they learned whilst they were at the Boys Club.
So what you're publishing is a great resource for current thinking and planning within social environment. I can very much see why that's very inspiring, and that obviously drives you.
It does, yeah. I was able to flourish in the sport of volleyball, loved it. Probably about 5,000 lads went through the club from 1941 to 2004, and they all have something they took from the club, and clearly a lot of the lads like to give things back, and I wasn't able to give a lot back when I left because I carried on playing sport. But I feel now there's something I really want to do to actually help tell the story so people don't forget what great contribution boys clubs did to society when they were around in the country.
We wanted to learn a little bit more about Bristol Books and where it's going. Have you got a website that we could go to?
Well, we've just got a blank page at the moment, but I think it's www.bristolbooks.org.
Clive Belton, thank you so much for talking about Bristol Books.
Okay, nice to see you again.
Thank you.
Our next feature comes from the Arnolfini, and it's an interview with Sean Griffiths, an architect, who's well respected for his innovative and imaginative design practice.
Your architecture was quite amazing, quite wacky.
Thanks, Rob.
Could you just say a few words? Is it a revolt against the kind of development that we're seeing springing it all over our towns?
I think that's probably a good enough reason to do it. Yeah, I get distressed by what I call a kind of Esperanto architecture that is appearing under the guise of billboards that say stunning development when they're built. And yet the only thing that's stunning about them is how horrible they are and how much they look like, for example, if they're being built in Bristol, exactly like the ones that are being built in Manchester, in Liverpool, in London, in Newcastle. We are very interested in introducing a sense of individuality and a sense of place to architecture.
Do you think we're kind of copying America, where everything's the same wherever you go in the States, so that you wouldn't even know where you were half the time?
Well, it's interesting. I live in London, and if you go to an area like Canary Wharf, you could be walking around an American city because it's designed by American architects for American developers, and other parts of the City of London are becoming like that. But I do think there's a kind of general trend which is not necessarily only American. It's to do with a kind of globalization of culture. So the same force that means that certain coffee chains are repeated endlessly throughout British cities are the same forces that say architecture looks like this, and this is what you do if you want to get planning permission and you want to sell it. I mean, a lot of it is driven by very commercial things, like estate agents encourage developers to do buildings that look like things they know have sold elsewhere. And so it means that they have a kind of, if it works, why fix it? But at the same time, I feel they're deadening lots of cities by doing lots of buildings that all look the same, and they have no character, and they have no differentiation, and they don't make places special. And we used to be much better at doing that sort of thing, I feel.
People aren't getting what they want. They're just being given it because there's no other choice.
Well, we are dominated by this thing that everybody talks about called the market. And the market presumably means people. And the market is what coffee maker or a developer of apartment blocks, what you think people want. And, you know, there is that dichotomy, isn't there, between what people actually want and what is available to people. So lots of people live in volume house building because it's what they can afford, and at that level of the market, that's what's on offer. And what we don't have, in particularly in housing, I think, in this country, is the attitude of somebody like Steve Jobs, who was the late chief of Apple, who said he never did market research because the public don't know what they want until you give it to them. And that kind of attitude, it would be great to see that in house building, for example. You know, what could we give people? How could we use our imagination to make houses with the same kind of attitude that Apple had when they thought, well, how do you do a phone, for example?
Your architectural projects are fantastic. And one of them was quite extraordinary. Was it Grayson?
Yeah, Grayson Perry. Yeah, we are privileged to be working with Grayson, who is an amazing character and an amazing artist, who on the one hand is incredibly clever and intellectual with amazing ideas, but on the other hand has an amazing ability to connect with the public through both his artwork, which is very, very popular. For example, his exhibition at the British Museum was extended by popular demand. But also he's on television, he writes stuff, he's appeared on Have I Got News For You? And there's something about his persona which we really admire, because what he is trying to do with art is quite similar to what we're trying to do with architecture, which is to make something which is intelligent but which reaches out to an audience.
Well, if people out there want to see your designs, to realise what can be done rather than all this boring Mickey Mouse architecture that's being dished out by the developers, do you have a website?
Do you have a website? www.fat.co.uk. It usually comes up next to Weight Watchers when you Google it because of the FAT bit of it. But yeah, I think you would find, well, hopefully you'll find some extraordinary things that are interesting to look at and contemplate on the website.
That was Sean Griffiths, architect, talking to our reporter Anthea Page at the Arnolfini here in Bristol. Before we join students at the music department of Bristol University as they rehearse for their opera production of A Midsummer Night's Dream, we're going to hear The Wedding March, number 9 from the ballet music of A Midsummer Night's Dream by Mendelssohn.
Thank you.
James, University of Bristol Music Department. Next year they're going to put on Benjamin Britten's Midsummer Night's Dream.
I'm Dave Ridley and I'm conducting the opera and MDing it.
And I'm Claudia and I'm directing the opera.
Tell us the story of Benjamin Britten.
Well, Benjamin Britten, it was still when the Aldeburgh Festival, which is a festival that he founded in the late 50s, he got commissioned to write the opera from the festival and decided on the Shakespeare, which is the first Shakespeare he set. And he wrote it in about 7 months, which is extraordinarily quick for an opera of this size. It's about 2.5 hours long, and it's got a cast of 23. And what he did was, with his partner Peter Piers, he cut down the opera into size, got rid of the whole of the first act of the original Shakespeare, and set the whole thing in the forest. And so in the opera itself, you're immediately plunged into the lovely, luscious world of the fairies and all their arguments and torments before the lovers turn up and make things very interesting.
There is traditional ways of presenting this opera, but you're going to do it slightly different.
There are obviously very classical ways of presenting the opera. Although the thing I think that's different about this opera to a lot of the older operas is that obviously it's a very modern opera in itself, and it was written in the 60s. So the way we want to do it is, and to put a slightly different take on it, is because the fairy world is so important and is what differentiates the opera from the play, we want to really focus on the magic of the fairy world. And so we're going to have a lot of UV and a lot of things like that, especially with the fairies, so that when the lights go down, there are these other little creatures that seem to emerge, which really sort of make the humans feel very out of place and very lost in this magical, tumultuous world which they've stumbled into. So, yeah, we're going to have lots of lights and massive, massive plants and foliage, just, and we want to cover the theatre as much as we can to make everyone feel like they're lost in this other world.
Another thing to add about the fairies is that Britten originally wrote for a kind of undisclosed amount of boy trebles to be involved as the fairies. Obviously, as a university, we don't have access to like a large number of boy singers. So instead, we're casting it as young soprano voices. So, I mean, obviously, our cast range from about 18 to 24-year-olds. And so lots of our sopranos are relatively young and can sing almost like kind of young boys. But instead of having them as innocent young spirits, we're having them as aggressive, feisty Amazonian ladies who will hopefully terrify the audience and terrify Puck and terrify Bottom at various parts of the opera.
Will they be wearing very little then?
Well, what we're going for, we have a specific set designer and costume designer on board, and I think at the moment they're playing around with the UV thing, obviously. I think a lot of their costumes are going to be covered in lots of flowers, but the way they're moving is not going to be jittering about like pretty fairies. They're very grounded, they're very close to the earth, sort of crawling around. So obviously in terms of costumes, they're going to have to be covered up to a slightly, like, so they're comfortable to move around. Yeah, we're really playing around. We want all the fairies to have slightly different costumes, but when the UV lights come on, for them to seem like a completely different being.
Principal fairies, Oberon and Titania, what will they be wearing?
Well, at the moment, our set designers and costume designers are looking at having incredible headpieces, and we're looking at face paint at the moment, but in a very tribal pattern. But at the moment, we don't want to give away too many of the secrets of the opera. We want them to be surprises when people come and see it. But we're experimenting with Oberon's costume especially, and we want his costume to very much sort of blend into the background and disappear and then all of a sudden appear.
Do you have a budget? Who's doing all the work? Is it students again making the sets and doing all the...
We have a budget. The problem is with our budget is that it's basically based on how many tickets we can sell, and we have to guess how many tickets we'll be able to sell, and we have to put a price on them. We have to have student price tickets, otherwise students won't come and watch. And so our budget is naturally a lot lower than what you'd expect for opera. So we're lucky though in the fact that we don't have to pay anyone, and everyone involved is doing it on a kind of amateur basis. Even so, our budget is incredibly small, and we have to be very inventive with how we make our costumes and, well, do everything, really.
The pool of talent we have at the university is quite incredible, so it's going to be a great production, whatever happens. And obviously, the budget just dictates how much we can play around with set and costume and things like that. But in terms of the show and in terms of the singers we have and the orchestra, it's going to be an incredible show, whatever happens, really.
Is this your first show?
It's my first opera, and it's my first real bout of orchestral conducting. So it is very much a case of being thrown right in at the deep end. But in terms of direction, I've worked on a couple of shows before.
How big is the orchestra?
The orchestra is 27 pieces. So we're looking at 12 string players, 2-1-2-1 in the woodwind, if you know what that means. Two horns, one trumpet, one trombone, two harps and two percussion players. And that makes 27. And they're all selected from the different university ensembles. But the music is incredibly interesting and varied. And each of the instrumentalists is used to quite a degree, usually along with a character. So, for example, the trombone follows bottom around stage and puts in the odd slide here and there for comic effect. Although it's never kind of slapstick. In general, it's been very easy to persuade players to get involved because it's a very fun thing to want to play.
So, in terms of Britain, it's the centenary of his birth next year. Do you think he will become more popular than ever?
I think that the Britain Peers Foundation will be just supporting every single Britain project, and there'll be a lot of Britain at the proms next year. I think that he will definitely become more popular than ever. Well, I think he's the most important contribution to kind of the English canon in the 20th century, especially with regard to opera. And I think, there'll just be a huge amount of him around next year, and what a better way to start it off than our opera, like, in the second month.
So what was his most famous opera?
Yeah, probably Peter Grimes, maybe Turn of the Screw. There's lots of community opera that have bred down to a more amateur level, like Noah's Flood, which a lot of people have heard of, yet no big productions done of that because it's usually, generally, amateur production. Midsummer Night's Dream's quite well known too. There's not one standout, like, opera that he's famous for. I think he wrote between 13 and 15 full-scale operas, though, and quite a lot of them were chamber operas. He wrote one big work at the beginning and then went back into chamber opera, and then wrote a lot of community opera as well, which is almost a completely different genre.
You're in rehearsal at the moment. When will the opera be performed?
The last 2 days of February, so the 27th and the 28th, and then the 1st and 2nd of March as well. At the moment, we don't currently have a website, but we're going to have a massive publicity push come the new year, so we're going to have about 2 or 3 months where hopefully there'll be a lot of Midsummer Night's Dream promotion. But also, it's probably worth mentioning, on the final night we have a gala performance which includes a champagne reception, and it's a black tie event as well to make a proper occasion of it. It's in the Students' Union in the Winston Theatre.
That interview came from the Music Department of Bristol University. Next year marks the centenary of the birth of Benjamin Britten on the 22nd November 1930. That's all from Backchat this week. Features were by Anthea Page. Studio engineer was Adrian Petrosky. And the producer was Anthea Page. So it's goodbye from me, Kirsty Paul, until next week. Goodbye.